time off at the house of someone who knew someone in my postnatal mother and baby group who lived in Crouch End. At the end of the day, the woman reported that Emily had cried constantly, save for an hour, when they had watched a video of Sleeping Beauty that seemed to comfort her. That day, my daughter formed her first sentence, "Won't go home." But I was not there to hear it, nor was I at the home where she so badly wanted to go. So, no, Paula is not ideal. But what is ideal? Mummy staying at home and laying down her life for small feet to walk over? Would you do that? Could I do that? You don't know me very well if you think I could do that. I get out of the bath, apply some aqueous cream to scaly pink patches on hands, backs of knees and ears, wrap myself in a robe and go into the study to check messages before bed. To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer. "Catherine, I don't remember mentioning drink, but disorderly sounds great. Bed for a week could be a problem. May need to reschedule the diary. Perhaps we should make it an oyster bar. Love, Jack."
Love? From a major client? Oh, God, Kate, now see what you've gone and done.
Must remember. Cut Ben's nails. Christmas thank you letters. Also letter bollocking council about failure to remove Christmas tree. Humiliate ghastly guy in front of Rod to show who's boss. Learn to send text messages. Ben birthday. Find Teletubby's cake. Present. Dancing Tinky Winky or improving wooden toy. Dancing Tinky Winky and improving wooden toy. Emily shoes / schools. Teacher to read. Call Mum. Call Jill Cooper Clark. Must return sister's call. Why Julie sounding so pissed off with me? Only person in London not seen brill new film Magic Tiger, Puffing Dragon? Half term, when, what? Invite friends for Sunday lunch. Buy pine nuts and basil to make own pesto. Cookery crash course. Leith's or similar. Summer holiday brochures. Get Jesus an exercise ball. Quote for stair carpet. Light bulbs, tulips, lip salve. Botox? Chapter 9. The first time I saw Jack. 7:03 a.m. I am hiding in the downstairs loo with my suitcase to avoid Ben. He is next door in the kitchen, where Richard is giving him breakfast. I am desperate to go in, but tell myself it's not fair to snatch a few selfish minutes of his company and then leave an inconsolable baby. The book says children get over separation anxiety by 2 years, but no age limit is given for mothers. Better he doesn't see me at all. Squatting in here on the laundry basket, I have time to study the room and notice swags of grey fluff drifting down the window, like witches' curtains. Our cleaner, Juanita, suffers from vertigo and quite understandably cannot clean above waist height. Also, the mermaid mosaic splashback was left half-tiled by our builder when we refused to give him any more cash, so is all tits and no tail. In the Bible, Jehovah sent floods and plagues of locusts to punish mankind for their vanity. At the end of the 20th century, he saves time and sends round a plasterer and a couple of brickies. Through the closed door I can make out muffled brum-brums, followed by Ben's gluey Sid James cackle. Rich must be pretending that spoonfuls of shreddies are advancing cars to get him to open his mouth. A honk from outside announces the arrival of Pegasus. I'm slipping out of my own house like a thief when there is an accusatory woo from the Volvo parked across the street. Angela Brunt, ringleader of the local mafia. Face like a Ford Anglia, with protuberant headlamp peepers set in a triangular skull, Angela is heroically plain. It's barely 7 o'clock. What's she doing out? Probably just back from taking Davina to pre-dawn Japanese. Give Angela 30 seconds, and she'll ask me if I've got Emily into a school yet.
Hello, Kate. Long time no see. Have you got Emily into a school yet?
5 seconds. Yes, and Angela has beaten her own world record for educational paranoia. Tempted to tell her we're considering the local state primary. With any luck, we'll induce massive on-the-spot coronary.
I think St. Stephen's is still a possibility, Angela.
Really? The headlamps do a startled circuit of their sockets.
But how are you going to get her in anywhere decent at 11? Did you read the inspector's latest report on St. Stephen's? No, I... And you do realize state school pupils are 2.4 years behind the independent sector after 18 months, rising to 3.2 by age 9.
Gosh, that does sound bad.
Well, Richard and I are going to look round Piper Place, but it sounds a bit pressurized. What I really want is for Emily to, you know, be happy while she's still so little.
Angela shies at the word happy like a horse at a rattlesnake.
Well, I know they've all got anorexia in the sixth form at Piper Place, she says brightly, but they do offer a terrific, well-rounded education.
Great. My daughter will become the world's first well-rounded anorexic. Admitted to Oxford weighing 75 pounds, she will rise from her hospital bed and take a dazzling first in philosophy. She will then do a job for 6 years, become a mother, give up work because it's all too much, and spend her mornings in Coffee Republic, decoding the entrance requirements for St. Paul's over skinny lattes with the fluent Japanese-speaking housewife, Davina Brunt.
Jesus, what is the matter with these women? Sorry, Angela, gotta run. Plane to catch.
Still struggling to pull the minicab door to on its gouty hinges when Angela fires her parting shot.
Look, Kate, if you're serious about getting Emily into Piper Place, I can give you this psychologist's number. Everyone's using him. He'll coach her to draw the right sort of picture at the interview.
I take a deep, grateful breath of the sweet, ganja-rich air in the back of Winston's cab. It takes me back to mellower days, a time before children, when being irresponsible was almost a duty.
And what does the right sort of picture look like, Angela?
The Brunt woman laughs.
Oh, you know, imaginative, but not too imaginative.
God, how I despise myself after conversations with Angela Brunt. I can feel Angela's maternal ambition getting into me like a flu bug. You try to fight it. You try to stick with your hunch that your child will do perfectly okay without being force-fed facts like some poor little foie gras gosling. But one day your immune system's a bit low, and bam, Angela's in there with her league tables and her average reading scores and her psychologist's phone number. You know what's really pathetic? In the end, I'll probably put Emily down for anorexia high. Fear of what insanely competitive schooling will do to my child is outweighed only by fear of holding her back, of her somehow falling behind and it's being my fault. And the race starts earlier every year. There's actually a kindergarten in our borough with a wall devoted to the Impressionists. The mothers have reluctantly come round to the idea that money can't buy you love, but they think that money can buy you money, and that's good enough for them. Exhausted working mothers helplessly enrolling their girls in academies of stress. It's not the only way, but maybe it's the only way we understand anymore. Stress, success. They even rhyme. 9:28 a.m.
What's that lady's problem?
What?
Winston is studying me in the rearview mirror. His eyes, so brown they're almost black, are flecked with laughter.
Angela!
Oh, I don't know. Urban angst, frustrated woman living vicariously through her kids, insufficient oral sex, the usual. Winston's laugh fills the cab. Deep and grainy, it reverberates in my solar plexus and, just for a moment, calms me. Traffic on the way to the airport is so heavy, I have plenty of time to dwell on the forthcoming ordeal of meeting Abelhammer. When I talked to Rod Task last night, he said,
Jack seems pretty excited about meeting you, Katie.
That'll be because of Greenspan's 0.5% interest rate cut, I improvised.
Could hardly tell my boss that I have sent my client email promising disorderly conduct and a week in bed, not to mention love and kisses.
Can't seem to stop scratching. Washed my hair last night with new shampoo. Allergic reaction, maybe. Or perhaps I've picked up some lower life form in the back of Pegasus. Like a swamp, the prehistoric cab could easily be breeding ground for any number of invertebrates. On the other hand, the music swirling round it hails from the opposite end of human development. The hot blare of trumpets and the syncopated snap of the percussion remind me of Rhapsody in Blue.
Is that Gershwin, Winston? He shakes his head.
Ravel.
My cab driver listens to Ravel?
We are passing the Hoover factory when the slow movement starts. It's the saddest thing I've ever heard. Halfway through, a flute comes in and just sort of breathes over the piano. When I close my eyes, I see a bird hovering over the sea. 3 p.m., East Coast time, office of Salinger Foundation. Arrive with a spinning head at the office of the appalling Abelhammer, just round the corner from the World Financial Center, accompanied by my assistant, Guy, who shows no sign of jet lag. On the contrary, Guy is hideously up to speed and knows the Nasdaq fluctuations better than his own pulse. Have picked out suitably off-putting outfit for presentation to Abelhammer. Chaste. Charcoal. Below the knee. Sicilian widow's shoes. The look is Maria von Trapp before she cut up those bedroom curtains. My resolve to keep tone of meeting a couple of degrees below zero melts when Jack Abelhammer walks in. Instead of the grey-haired Brooks Brothers patrician I had imagined, here is a languid, close-cut jock, around the same age as me, with a slow-release George Clooney smile that reaches his eyes before the mouth is fully engaged. Damn. Damn.
Well, Kate Reddy, says the appalling Abelhammer, it's a real pleasure to put a face to all those figures you've been sending me.
Huh. I update Salinger on performance of the fund over the past 6 months. Everything easy-peasy until one of Jack's junior consultants, a scowling Agent Scully redhead, pushes wire specs up bridge of nose and says,
Can I ask if your forecast returns for Japan are so low? Why are you overweight in Japan?
Ah, now that's a very perceptive question. One for you, Guy, I think. Graciously deferring to my assistant, I take a seat and sit back to watch the little creep try to wriggle his way out of that one. Casually check mobile. Text message from Paula Potts to Kate Reddy. Emily sent home from school with nits. Whole family must be treated. You too. Cheers, Paula. I can hardly believe what I'm reading. Have travelled across the Atlantic, importing lice like Colorado beetles. Excuse myself from meeting and hurtle to the loo. In the seasick green light of the executive washroom, I try to examine hair, pulling strands away from head. What do nits look like? Can see cluster of eggs near parting, but possibly dandruff. Frantically comb hair. It is impossible to get out of pre-arranged dinner with Abelhammer. Can hardly use emergency pest control as excuse. 7:30 p.m. Brody's Seafood Restaurant. Over dinner, sit very upright like Queen Mary and some distance away from table. Vision of busy nits rappelling down into client's clam chowder.
Can I offer you a lift back to the hotel, Kate? Asks Jack.
Fine. But can we stop at a drugstore? I need to get something. His eyebrows rise in expectation. I mean shampoo. I have to wash my hair.
Now? You want to wash your hair right now?
Yes. Get London out of my hair.
Atta girl. Imaginative, but not too imaginative.
Reasons not to have affair with Abelhammer. 1. Have not had legs waxed since Halloween. 2. Nits could parascend onto immaculate Harvard Business School buzz cut. 3. Major client, ergo unprofessional. 4. Am married. Shouldn't these points be in a different order? Chapter 10. Birthday. Friday, 6:02 a.m. Today is my son's first birthday, and I am sitting in the sky 3,000 feet above Heathrow. The plane is much delayed. Poor visibility, crowded airways. We have been doing this for 53 minutes now, the altitude equivalent of treading water, and it's making me nervous. Can feel my shoeless feet flexing under the blanket to try and keep us aloft. I think of all those jumbos whispering past each other in the fog. Over the PA comes the voice of the pilot, one of those chummy call-me-Pete types. Heart sinks. At moments like this, do not want pilot to be called Pete. Urgently want pilot to be chap named Roger Carter from Weybridge, wing commander, Battle of Britain type, mistress in Agadir, good friend of Raymond Baxter from Tomorrow's World. sort of cove who could bring us into land with one hand tied to his handlebar moustache if necessary. You see, I have to stay alive. I am a mother. Pilot tells us we will have to head for Stansted. We are running low on fuel. No cause for concern. No, none at all. Today is Ben's birthday. I need to land safely to collect Teletubby's cake from bakery, also to dress my son for his first party in burgundy cords and soft cream shirt before Paula can put him into the Desert Storm khaki grunge she favours. Dying is totally out of the question. For a start, Richard could never bring himself to tell Emily about periods. He would delegate to his mother, and Barbara would give Em a brief talk about personal freshness before producing something called a sanitary napkin. And she would refer to sex as that department, as in, there's nothing amiss between Donald and me in that department, thank you. In the great universal stores of life, I believe that department is to be found on the floor between ladies' separates and domestic appliances. No, no, no. I have to live. I am a mother. Death wasn't really an issue before. I mean, obviously you wanted to avoid it for as long as possible. But ever since having the children, I see the unsmiling man with the scythe everywhere, and I jump higher and higher to avoid his swishing blade. Everything all right for you, madam? In this, the dimmest possible cabin light, the flight attendant has become a letterbox of lipstick around an ice-white smile. I address myself to the teeth. Actually, it's my baby's first birthday today, and I was hoping to be home by breakfast. Well, I promise you we're doing all we can. Can I get you some water? With scotch. Thanks. 8:58 a.m. Stansted Airport. Refueled plane still sitting on the tarmac. Pontius pilot says it's not his fault. We have to go back to Heathrow. Oh, this is just marvellous. As we gain height, two empty whiskey miniatures skitter off my tray, nearly landing in the lap of the woman across the aisle. She bestows a languorous smile on me, readjusts her mint-green pashmina, then opens a Gucci travel bag, takes out aromatherapy bottle and dots lavender onto pulse points, applies face spritz before taking thoughtful sips from a large bottle of Evian, lets her lustrous, knit-free head sink back onto dinky grey cashmere pillow. I want to reach over, tap her on the arm, and ask if I can buy her life. Once I'm sure the goddess is safely asleep, I furtively open my own bag. Contents: two emergency sachets of Calpol, unwashed white medicine spoon with jammy rim, spare knickers for Emily, swimming, knit comb, purchased for self in New York City, lone grubby Tampax, hideous puce Pokemon toy from last weekend's Crisis McDonald's visit, orange felt tip minus top, Pongy Pete the puppy book, wad of Kleenex dyed orange by felt tip, pack of Banoffee flavour limited edition munchies, disgusting but only three left, Coco Chanel miniature eau de toilette, atomizer broken, Little Miss Busy book which Emily pressed on me for the journey. Between my wallet and a wad of dried out Pampers wipes, I find Jack Abelhammer's card with home number and message scrawled on back. Any time. At the sight of his handwriting, I get a sensation of claws scuttling across the floor of my belly, the sensation of far-off teenage crushes, of sex when it was still as much a puzzle as a thrill. Over dinner in New York, Jack and I talked about everything. Music, movies, Tom Hanks, the new Jimmy Stewart, the poetry of Emily Dickinson, Kate Blanchett's Elizabeth I, Apollo 13, Jelly Beans, Art Tatum, Rome versus Venice, the mysterious allure of Alan Greenspan, even the stocks I am buying for him. Everything except children. Why didn't you mention your children, Kate? 2:07 p.m. Back from Heathrow, dash into office to show my face. Create impression of intense activity by piling books and financial journals on my desk, then call my landline from my mobile and keep it ringing. Pick it up and have animated, can-do conversation with myself about hot new stock before hanging up. Tell Guy I have to pop out and collect some vital research. Hail cab and get driver to take me to Highbury Corner and wait outside bakery while I leap out to pick up Teletubby's cake. Not bad. Poe a little po-faced, perhaps, and Lala more mustard than yellow. 10 minutes later, pulling into our street, can see a blue balloon tied to the front door. As I walk into the house, Ben waddles into the hall, gives a yowl of recognition, and starts to cry. Fall to my knees, gather him in, and hug him tight. This time last year, he was minutes old, naked except for a buttery coat of vernix. Today, dressed by Paula, he is in a red and white soccer strip with Adams emblazoned on the back. I do not let on how much this upsets me. Instead, when she leaves the kitchen, I calmly hand Ben a carton of tooth-kind Ribena and watch as he upends it, drizzling purple flood from neck to navel.
"Oh, dear," I say loudly. "Not juice all over your lovely football kit. Better go upstairs and get changed."
Yes!
4 p.m. Ben's party is full of Paula's nanny friends with their charges, many of whom I don't recognize. They are part of his life without me. When these unfamiliar girls say his name and my son lights up with pleasure, I feel a twinge of... what? If I didn't know better, I'd call it remorse. In the sitting room, a handful of non-working mums are in animated conversation about a local nursery school. They hardly seem to notice their kids, whom they handle with an enviable, invisible touch, like advanced kite flyers, while the mothers inferior, like me, over-attend to our clamorous offspring. There is an uneasy standoff between the two kinds of mother, which sometimes makes it hard for us to talk to each other. I suspect that the non-working mother looks at the working mother with envy and fear because she thinks that the working mum has got away with it, and the working mum looks back with fear and envy because she knows that she has not. In order to keep going in either role, you have to convince yourself that the alternative is bad. The working mother says, "Because I am more fulfilled as a person, I can be a better mother to my children," and sometimes she may even believe it. The mother who stays home knows that she is giving her kids an advantage, which is something to cling to when your toddler has emptied his beaker of juice over your last clean T-shirt. Here in the kitchen, though, I find solace in the company of a handful of familiar women, the tattered remnant of my original postnatal mother and baby group. Amazing to think we've known each other for more than 5 years now. Judith, the plump brunette over by the microwave, used to be a patent agent. Went back to work for a couple of years, but then one day she discovered dog hairs in the back of the family Peugeot. Trouble was they didn't have a dog. Told herself it was nothing to worry about, until the gnawing sensation in her stomach drove her to slip out of work. Parked outside her own house and trailed the nanny to a flat off the Holloway Road. Inside the unlocked door, she found Joshua fenced in a corner behind a fire guard, watched over by an Alsatian, while the nanny, Tara, amused herself in the next room with a boyfriend who had a Metallica tattoo on one of his pumping buttocks. We all told Judith it was just incredibly bad luck, a single rotten apple in the wholesome nanny barrel.
"But what if he saw something, Kate?" she sobbed down the phone.
"Josh didn't see anything, Judy. He's not even 3, and they don't remember a thing before they're 5. But Judith never risked childcare again. We knew that she tortured herself with the thought of the dog's jaw so close to her baby's face because, back in those early days, we lacerated our consciences every time we got home and found a new bump or graze on our own infants. These things happened. It was the fact that they happened off your watch that seemed to hurt. And then there was the secret, never-to-be-spoken conviction that you would have got there sooner. Got to the table corner before her forehead struck, to the tarmac before his tiny knee. AWACS, isn't that what the military calls it? Nature gives mother an advance warning system, and mother is convinced that no minder or man can match her for speed or anticipation. Judith didn't object when her husband Nigel said that, as she was no longer working, she could get up for the kids whenever they woke in the night. And, as he was under such pressure at the bank, he would need to take a skiing holiday, while Judith got on with the relaxing business of being at home with 3 children under 4. The twins arrived soon after the nanny left. The Judith I first knew would have told hubby where to get off, but that Judith had long disappeared. The rest of us held firm for a while to the conviction that we had been educated for something better than the gentle warming of Barbie pasta. But then, one by one, we stopped. Giving up, isn't that what they call it? Well, I'm not calling it that. Giving up sounds like surrender, but these were honorable campaigns, bravely fought and not without injury. Did my fellow novice mothers give up work? No, work gave them up, or at least made it impossible for them to go on. Karen, she spooning jelly into Ella's mouth, found herself sidelined at her accountancy firm after it was made crystal clear by the opaque route of nod and wink that after having Louis, she was no longer considered partnership material. Taking her eyes off the career path for a few months, she had found herself on what they call the mummy track. The mummy track has the appearance of a through road. You can travel for many hundreds of miles along it before you notice you're going nowhere. Karen thought she could do her job in 4 days, one of those days at home. Her boss agreed, and that was the problem. If Karen managed, he said, it would create an unhelpful precedent. Funny thing is, when you're starting out, you assume their babyhood will be the hard part, that if you can just butch your way through those fuzzy first weeks, then everything will return to normal. But it gets worse. At least at 6 months of age, they can't tell you it's you that they want. 5.5 years after the birth of our babies, only 3 out of our original group of 9 still have jobs. Caroline is a graphic designer in advertising, but based at home, so she gets to squeeze all her work in round Max's school times. She couldn't make it today because she was putting the finishing touches to a brochure for IBM. Alice, cute face, raven bob, leather gilet, over by the sink, went back to being a director of documentaries that won awards for rooting out corruption in high places and a particularly plangent kind of sadness in low ones. Every night when she got in late from the editing suite, Alice carried a sleeping Nathaniel into her bed. When else would she get to hold him? It was only for a little while, only while he was little. But Nat didn't grasp that his lease on paradise was short. Soon he was lying across the width of the bed, forcing his mother and father into narrow coffins at each side. When Jacob came along, Alice took him into bed too. Soon afterwards, her partner Don left home, citing a 19-year-old researcher and irreconcilable sleeping arrangements. I look at Alice now, gaunt as an addict. From a distance, she looks as youthful as when we first met. But up close, you see how motherhood has stolen her bloom. The boys seem to have literally sucked her blood. She may have won a BAFTA, but her sons are even needier by night than the talent she corrals by day. And how would she find the time to meet a new man, even if there was one out there willing to take on the bolshy scions of another male? Reading my thoughts, she says with a grim smile, "My only fix now is the boys, Kate." I place my hand on the golden orb of my own boy's head. A clump of chocolate Rice Krispies is nesting in his left ear. Time to sing happy birthday. Paula produces a Zippo from her pocket to light the candles. Christ, she's not smoking now, is she? I carry the cake to the table. Ben's eyes are watery with wonder, mine with regret at the fleetingness of it all. Is this the last time I'll see a baby of mine turn one? And how much of that first year have I actually seen? "Oh, Kate, you shouldn't have gone to so much trouble," says Alice, eyebrow raised and gesturing at the Teletubbies icing. "Bad mother," I mouth silently at her across the table. Laughing, she whispers back, "Me too." Must remember. Knits, cheese, Valentine's card. Chapter 11. Reason Not the Need. It's hard to explain how my relationship with Jack began. I really wasn't looking for anyone. I wasn't happy, but I wasn't unhappy either. I was in the grey survival zone where I imagine most of us live most of the time. When a badly injured patient gets admitted to casualty, the hospital staff do what they call triage. Triage is the assignment of degrees of urgency to decide the order of treatment of wounds. I first heard the term one night when I was watching ER on Channel 4. It was that riveting period when we were all wondering how things would work out between Hathaway and Doug, and I thought how much triage sounded like my life. Daily existence was a constant assessment of who needed my attention most, the children, the office, or my husband. You'll notice I leave myself out of that list, and that's not because I'm a good and selfless person. Far from it. Selfishness just wasn't an option. No time. Most weekends, on the drive home from the supermarket, I would look through the steamed-up windows of a cafe and see a couple, fingertips touching over cappuccino, or a lone man reading a newspaper, and I would long to go in there and order a drink and just sit and sit. But it was impossible. When I wasn't at work, I had to be a mother. When I wasn't being a mother, I owed it to work to be at work. Time off for myself felt like stealing. The fact that no man I knew ever felt that way didn't help. This was just another area in which we were unequal. Mothers got the lioness's share of the guilt. So the last thing, the very last thing I needed was someone else to love. And then the email started. In the weeks that followed our first dinner in New York, Jack emailed me, first daily and then hourly. Sometimes we would reply to each other within seconds, and it felt like one of those rallies in a tennis match where a great return spurs the other player to an inspired lob. I was cool at first, but he was so playful and persistent that natural competitiveness took over, and I was soon running to the back of the court to retrieve the ball and return it with some topspin. So no, I didn't need him, but he created a jack-shaped need in me, a need that only he could satisfy. Does the woman in the desert know how thirsty she is till they press the bottle to her lips? I started to look forward to the name Abelhammer dropping into my inbox more than I have looked forward to anything in my life. To Kate Reddy, EMF, from Jack Abelhammer.
NASDAQ hit like Pearl Harbor. Heavy casualties. Client seeks considered professional opinion of respected British fund manager. Should I shoot myself now or wait till after lunch? Jack.
To Jack Abelhammer from Kate Reddy. Rest assured, respected fund manager has you constantly in mind. Awaiting interest rate pronouncement from Al Mighty Greenspan. Professional opinion? Long-term recovery inevitable. Don't shoot. Unprofessional opinion? Hide under desk till shelling stops. Go out and see if any stock left standing. Eat turkey club sandwich. Then shoot. Catherine. Kisses. To Kate Reddy from Jack Abelhammer.
Did you know Alan Greenspan's wife said he was so oblique that when he asked her to marry him, she didn't even notice? That guy's harder to read than Thomas Pynchon. Hey, shouldn't you be in bed? Middle of the night there, right?
To Jack Abelhammer from Kate Reddy. I like the night. More time in it than the day. Why waste it in bed? Kay, kisses. To Kate Reddy from Jack Abelhammer.
Bed not invariably a waste of time. Do you know that speech where the guy tells his lover he wishes that 7 years were rolled into one night? Must be Shakespeare, right?
To Jack Abelhammer from Kate Reddy. 7 years in one night sounds just about enough hours to pay off my sleep debt. Not Shakespeare. Marlowe, I think. That's the unfair thing about Shakespeare, though. Everything beautiful belongs to him, whether he wrote it or not. He's the Bill Gates of emotional software. How come you read Marlowe, anyway? Did the Wall Street Journal predict a resurgence in Renaissance playwrights? To Kate Reddy from Jack Abelhammer.
Unfair, milady, unfair. Don't judge a man by his portfolio. Was once a poor, struggling English major, but had to find a way of financing my first editions habit. Some men buy boats. I buy a first edition of Ulysses. What's your excuse?
To Jack Abelhammer from Kate Reddy. Was once a poor struggling English minor. Poverty, when it's not being boring, is really quite scary. I didn't want to be scared all my life. In Britain there are plenty of people who will tell you money doesn't matter. These are the people we call the middle classes. Owning first edition, such a boy's own thing. Respectfully suggest, sir, you should spend your money on something really important, like shoes. Kay, kisses. To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer.
Do you realize you have now sent me exactly 147 kisses, and I have not sent you a single one?
To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy. It had crossed my mind.
To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer. Kisses, X's, to fill two pages.
7:01 a.m. Ben has discovered his penis. Lying on the changing mat, he wears the rapt, triumphant expression of a being who has just found the on-off switch for the solar system. Small fingers curled tight around the original joystick. He is absolutely outraged and sheds fat, warm tears when I confiscate his favorite new toy by trapping it in a midi pamper and hastily sealing the Velcro flaps on each side.
No, there's a good boy. We have to put it away now and go downstairs and have our shreddies.
What is the correct mother-of-the-world attitude toward an infant son's sexuality? Delight that the penis works, of course. Amazement that I could, in my own female body, have grown this caterpillar-sized miracle of plumbing and pleasure. But also strange shyness at evidence of early masculinity, with all that it implies. Tractors, soccer, other women. One day Ben will have females in his life who are not me, and already a splinter of ice in the heart tells me how that will feel. Downstairs I pick my way across the debris on the kitchen floor. Over by the bin there is a hill of raisins. Surely can't be the same raisins that were there before Christmas. Must tell Paula to stop kids dropping them. No use asking cleaning lady. Juanita has problem with cartilage and cannot kneel down. I find Richard bowed in worshipful attitude before the TV. Unshaven, my husband is at his shaggiest and most primitive, like Ted Hughes left in a tumble dryer. Suspect he has developed a crush on children's TV presenter. Chloe? Zoe? And when I ask how come he has the kids' show switched on before either of ours is even awake, he murmurs, "Very educational," in a gruff, not-now woman manner. Don't think he has forgiven me since the great pesto row. I can't help noticing that Chloe Zoe is dressed for a Geordie hen night rather than a fierce February morning. She wears an orange sleeveless vest with "How about it?" picked out in pink sequins over small but inquisitive breasts. When did children's presenters start looking like jailbait rather than, say, the estimable Valerie Singleton?
Richard?
Yes?
Ben keeps fiddling with himself. I mean, he's only just one. Seems a bit early. Do you think it's normal?
Rich doesn't even look up. Happiest form of entertainment known to man. A lifetime's pleasure ahead of him. Plus it's free, he says, cocking his head on one side and returning Chloe Zoe's gruesome chipmunk grin. A gurgle of pleasure across the room makes me turn round. Ben has moved over to the fridge and yanked open the door and stands there upending an economy bottle of tooth-kind Ribena over my shoes. Black currant hemorrhaging all over the place. Dive into action, attempting to staunch the slick like the exotic yet authoritative Nurse Hathaway in ER. Call for more kitchen roll. There is no more kitchen roll, and Ben is now sitting in a puddle of purple glucose. He squeals when I pick him up by the collar of his pajamas and hold him under the tap. I ask Richard how he could have failed to get kitchen roll as per my underlined 3 times request on Friday's shopping list. Rich explains he was unable to find the specified kitten soft in the supermarket and simply couldn't bring himself to ask for it.
I don't understand.
There are certain words a grown man cannot be expected to say, Katie, and kitten soft are two of them.
You won't say kitten soft kitchen roll?
Not out loud, no.
Why on earth not?
I don't know. I just know I'd rather eat a soft kitten than ask for one. Even thinking those words. With a theatrical shudder, Richard turns to the TV and makes a silent appeal to the melting chocolate button eyes of Chloe Zoe.
But we don't have any kitchen roll, Rich. And, as you may have noticed, we have the Exxon Valdez going on here.
I know, but I wasn't sure if kitten thingy was the only option or if absorbent luxury 3-ply cushion stuff would do instead. He lets out a moose-sized groan. No, it's no good, Kate. Don't make me.
For future reference, I ask my husband to give me some other words grown men cannot be expected to say. In no particular order they are toilet duck, glade fresh, rich aroma, deep dish, fillet of fish, cheesy dipper, wash and go, body form, tubby custard, panty liner. 8:01 a.m. Got to dash. Major presentation to EMF directors today. A make-or-break career opportunity. A chance to impress with cool authority, matchless knowledge of world markets, etc. Swipe Ribena glaze off my shoes, leave note for Paula asking her to buy a kitchen roll, and please return Snow White video to the library. The fine now exceeds production costs on the original Walt Disney movie. Grab my bag and air-kiss Sticky Ben, who hurls himself at me like Daniel Day-Lewis bidding farewell to Madeleine Stowe in Last of the Mohicans.
Mom, what's a suffragette?
Emily is blocking my path to the door. Don't know, darling. Have a nice day. Bye now. 3:26 p.m. Presentation is going brilliantly. The managing director, Sir Alastair Cobbold, has just praised my grasp of the problems of European integration. Up here in the boardroom on the 17th floor, with London spread out like a Lego village beneath me, for one giddy moment I feel as though I am mistress of all I survey. I am just moving into the closing sequence, when there's a cough at the door. I look across and see Celia Harmsworth hovering in that fluttery, don't-mind-me way people who pretend they're unimportant have of making themselves the centre of attention. "So sorry to interrupt, Robin," she simpers, "but there's a drunk in reception, causing a few problems for security." Robin Cooper Clark raises an eyebrow.
"And what has that got to do with us, Celia?"
"The thing is, he says he's Kate's father." Chapter 12. Meet Kate's Dad. The pattern of meetings with my dad has not altered much in the last 20 years. For months on end, I don't hear from him, except for reports passed via my sister of scandalous excesses and a list of ailments you thought had died out with Lord Nelson. Lockjaw, scurvy, Vesuvian boils. Then one day, when I've given up on him, when the tug that feels like a bell pull on the heart has gone away, he pitches up and launches into a conversation that draws on a relationship we never had. My dad has always confused sentimentality and intimacy. As far as he's concerned, I'm still his little girl, although when I was a little girl, he asked things of me that demanded a woman's strength. Now that I'm grown, he wants a child's docility and is quick to anger when he doesn't get it. Sometimes he has been drinking, you can never be quite sure, but always, always he wants money. In the chrome and white lobby of Edwin Morgan Forster, Joseph Aloysius Reddy stands out like a creature from a more provisional, primitive age. Visitors in suits can't take their eyes off him. The disbelief he arouses is so strong he might as well be a bad smell. With a third-hand herringbone coat and a skein of grey hair, he's like a tinker come to sell his pots and pans to the crew of the Starship Enterprise. Two security guys with crackling walkie-talkies are trying to persuade him to move, but Joe is planted mulishly on one of reception's perforated steel benches, a white plastic bag slumped at his feet. He has the drunk's huffy dignity. Catching sight of me, he uncrosses his arms and points a triumphant finger.
There's our Cathy. What did I tell you?
Thanks, Gerald, I say quickly to the guard. My dad's not himself today. I'll take over now. Steer him to the door, making sure to look straight ahead to avoid the pitying smiles that have been the Reddy family's constant companions for almost as long as I can remember. Once we're safely outside, I mention a cheapside coffee shop, far out of the orbit of my colleagues, but Dad pulls me down the steps towards the King's Arms. A pub that Dickens knew, it has sawdust on the floor and a teenage barmaid with white skin and a studded tongue. We sit at a corner table under the portrait of a red-cheeked earl, my father with a double scotch and a maxi-pack of peanuts, and me with a bitter lemon. Bitter lemon was always my mum's drink. First it was a non-alcoholic beverage, only later did it become a state of mind.
"How's little Emma, then?" asks my father.
His breath is a powerful mixture of Johnny Walker and boiled eggs. Emily.
Aye, Emily. Must be going on 7 now.
6. She'll be 6 in June, Dad. He nods decisively, as though 6 is close enough to 7 to make no difference.
And the little lad? Julie says he has a look of me about him.
Jesus! There really is no parent so bad or so absent that he can't get a kick out of his genetic legacy. I stare furiously into my sour fizz. The mere idea that some ribbon of DNA with Joe Reddy printed on it is unfurling inside my darling son. Actually, Ben looks like me, Dad.
Well, we were always alike, you and me, Kathy Duck. Both lookers, good with figures, both with a bit of a temper on us, eh?
He snatches a swallow of whiskey and throws a handful of peanuts into his mouth. Everything in immoderation, my father. In that, at least, we are the same.
Well, aren't you going to ask your dad how he's going on, then? Come all this way to see you.
The accent is northern, so thick you could cut it like a fruitcake, but there is an echo of a lilt from his mother's native Cork. Did I really used to talk like that? Richard says that when he first met me, I sounded like something out of Monty Python. That was when I still said bath for bath, before I learned that class rhymes with arse. Although no one says arse down here, they say bum or bottom. I say bottom to my children now, and each time I falter on its plump, prissy contours. My tongue feels like that barmaid's, heavy with foreign objects. I know that Dad wants me to make it easier for him to ask for what he's come for. But I won't make it easy. I can still remember him standing outside the Abbey National in Holborn when I'd got my first paycheck and licking his finger to count the tenners I handed him. My own father. If he wants my money, let him ask for it. Same again. The barmaid has come over to clear our glasses. No.
Aye. Same for me. And get one in for yourself, love.
Dad smiles, and the girl flushes and straightens up in a way I have seen women do before in his presence. He was once a beautiful man, my father. Beautiful rather than handsome, and therefore doomed not to ripen but to rot.
Tyrone Power, my grandmother used to murmur fondly when she saw him,
and I, being young and not knowing any old Hollywood stars, assumed that Tyrone Power was the electric effect my father had on people, rather than a proper name, an unruly but irresistible force of nature. I look at him now and try to see what others must see. Face the shape of a swollen heart, the nose and cheeks stippled with red roots like the delta of some rusty river. Long lashes fringing what my mother claims were the most remarkable blue eyes you ever saw. Indigo pools where all that charm and intelligence drowned. A ladies' man, my first boyfriend called him.
Your dad's a bit of a one for the ladies, Kath. You should have seen him down the club with that Christine on Saturday night.
How I flush to hear mention of his sex life so close to mine.
See what you reckon to this.
My father fumbles under the table and out of his carrier bag produces a black box file and from that several well-thumbed sheets of graph paper. There is a drawing of something snouty and padded, with squared-off wings at the side. Pigs might fly? I turn it the other way up. What is it?
The world's first biodegradable nappy.
But you don't know anything about nappies.
I do now.
My dad, you should know, has a history in this area. One of the world's great undiscovered inventors, there is very little that he himself has not discovered. When Julie and I were still small, he cooked up moon rocks, powdery lumps of resin that were sold as souvenirs from the Apollo 11 landing off a market stall in Chesterfield.
Just think, madam, your hand is holding the very rock that Neil Armstrong held in his.
They bombed, did the moon rocks, and later, when space travel lost its luster, they had another incarnation as fancy pumice stones for the hard skin of the ladies of Worksop. Next came a cat flap that prevented pets bringing prey into the house. A good idea, but the cats kept getting garrotted in the springback mechanism. Sometimes Dad's invention had been invented already, like the blindfold he devised for in-flight passenger naps without having been on an airplane. "Joe," said Mum cautiously, I understand that they have eye shades on planes, but he refused to let such womanly nitpicking get him down. In our house, Dad was one for the broad sweep. Mum picked up the bits with a dustpan and brush. On his card, my father describes himself as an entrepreneur. As I skim through his business plan for Reddy's biodegradable nappy, he says happily,
I've had a lot of interest, you know. Derek Marshall at the Chamber of Commerce says he's never seen anything quite like it. But I'm a bit stuck for capital, love, and that's your line of work. What do they call it? Adventure capital.
Venture capital.
That's the one.
Dad says we're not talking big sums this time. Seed money, that's all. How much?
Just enough to get production up and running.
How much?
10 grand, plus development costs. Then there's packaging. Say 13 and a half. I wouldn't ask, love, only cash flow's that tight at the minute.
I'm not aware of my expression having altered, but it must have, because he shifts in his chair in a manner which, in another man, you might take for discomfort. For a moment I think it must have occurred to him how sick these transactions make me feel. He reaches across the table and places his hand on mine.
Don't worry, love, he says. If you're pushed, I'll take a check.
I leave my father at Old Street Station. From there he can get the Northern Line directly to King's Cross and take a train home. I give him money for the fare, a crazy amount. It's cheaper to fly to Boston than to go to Doncaster these days, and extra for a cab at the other end. Dad is a bit vague about where he is living at the moment, for which read who he is living with, but he promises me that he will go there directly. I stand outside the station, round the corner by the photo booth. When I look back inside a few minutes later, he has engaged a young busker in conversation. Casually, magnanimously, he flicks one of the tenors I have just given him into the boy's open guitar case, removes his coat, lays it gently over the busker's sleeping dog, and now, oh dear God, he is going to sing.
The water is wide, I cannot get o'er, and neither have I wings to fly. Give me a boat that will carry two, and both shall row, my love and I.
It's his favourite ballad, a ready standard along with Down by the Sally Gardens. The passing suits, scurrying for the escalator, stop and turn their heads, startled by the beauty of the tenor voice, the thwarted yearning Dad does so well. A woman in a camel coat bends to deposit some coins in the case, and my father tips an invisible hat to her. I can hear my mother's voice now, an angry descant piercing the sad tune.
He can wrap you round his little finger.
No, he can't.
Yes, he can. Always could. If he's so bloody marvellous, your father, go to him. Go on, go to him.
I don't want to go to him, Mum.
You always were his. Daddy's girl.
I plunge back into the noise of the street, buy a copy of the Standard to have something to hold in my hands, and head in the direction of the office. A child's love for a parent is well-nigh indestructible, but down the years the drip, drip, drip of disillusion can corrode it. The first feeling I remember having for my father was pride, a soaring, burst-your-lungs gratitude that he was mine. Better looking than anyone else's dad, he was so clever he could do any sum he liked in his head and recite the football results back as soon as they'd been read out on the telly on Saturday afternoon without a single mistake. Sheffield Wednesday, Partick Thistle, Hamilton Academicals. Saturday mornings, Julie and I would be allowed to accompany him to the bookies, where we would cling to his hero's legs. I remember the sense of being small down there in the forest of trousers and the smell of felt hats in from the rain. Years later, at university, I watched the middle-class fathers trudging back and forth from their family saloons, carrying tea chests and kettles and china mug sets hanging from pine trees, and I longed for their dull embrace. One winter, it must have been 75 or 76, Dad took us sledding out in the Peak District. Other families had shop-bought sleds, raised off the ground with a lattice of wooden struts to sit on. They had the grandeur of an old-fashioned sleigh ride. Our sled lay flush with the ground. Dad had hammered it together out of split logs and had added metal runners on the underside, which he ripped from the lip of an abandoned car door.
"Give it a bit of a go," he said, rubbing his hands together.
On the first run, Julie fell off right away, and the sled completed the descent by itself. Dad told her not to be such a baby. Now it was my turn, and I clung on, determined to prove that our sled, the sled our dad had made, was as good as anyone's. But halfway down the hill, it hit a ridge and veered sharply to the right, slicing towards a steep drop fenced off by a low curtain of barbed wire. The metal strips, added to give a bit of go, made the sled unstoppable. It slammed under the fencing, and the two front prongs dangled over the drop while I lay at the back, 2 feet from the edge, tangled in wire. He was panting so hard when he got to me, I thought he would die. But he knelt down on the end of the sled to hold it in place and picked the wire thorns out of my anorak, out of my hands, out of my hair. As the last piece of wire was unsnagged, he pulled me clear and the sled shot forward. It was a couple of seconds before we heard it crack on the road beneath. I used to think that I remembered that day so well because he had saved my life. Now I think it's because it was the only time in our years as father and daughter that he did anything to protect me. But Dad was my first love, and I always took his side, even when my mother's hazel eyes disappeared in big raccoon circles, and she started wearing those brushed nylon keep-out nighties and laughing in the wrong places. One day at the VG stores, a man knocked over the pyramid display of Ideal Milk. The little blue and white cans went tumbling everywhere, and Mum laughed and laughed until Linda, behind the counter, had to fetch a glass of water from out back. But daughters don't want to pick up the signals of their mother's unhappiness. It might mean their father isn't perfect. Years after it became clear that Joseph Aloysius Reddy was an unsuitable crush, I still couldn't break it off. How much evidence did I need? There was the day he brought the sheets home from the bed he shared with his new girlfriend for Mum to wash, and the night he carried me downstairs, blinking from sleep, to tell the copper standing in the front room that he, Joseph Reddy, had been at home on a date I had to swear I could remember, and I swore.
"She's got this photographic memory as our Cathy," said Dad to the policeman. "Haven't you, love? Now where's that lovely smile?"
A father is the template of a man that nature gives a girl, and if that template is broken or disfigured, well, what then? Walking through the front door of Edwin Morgan Forster, I am grateful for its cool, echoing spaces, for the clip-clop of marble underfoot, for the way the lift welcomes me without protest to its mirrored interior. I prefer not to look at the woman in the reflection. I don't want her seeing me like this. When the door opens on the 13th floor, I have my excuses ready, but Robin Cooper Clark is standing right there.
"Excellent presentation, Kate," he says, placing a hand awkwardly on my shoulder. "Absolutely first class. Just need to tie up a couple of loose ends. No hurry, in your own time. No real problems with the family, I trust?"
Hard to imagine what the head of investment would say if I told him the truth. The Cooper Clarks have become friends since Jill and I bonded in horror at some corporate pheasant shoot. Richard and I have been to their place in Sussex several times, but I have never mentioned my father to Robin. I want his respect, not his pity.
"No, everything's fine."
"Splendid. Talk later."
The screen tells me that in the 3 hours since I last looked, the FTSE is up 50, the Dow is down 100, and the dollar 1%. So steadily, and with great deliberation, I make the calculations I need to make to hold my funds on course. All I knew was that I wasn't going back there, to the scams, the evasions, the holding your breath in the dark hall.